From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Hank Williams had 4 short years at the top of the country music charts with hit songs like Hey Good Lookin' and Your Cheatin' Heart. But by the time of his death at 29, he could barely get a booking in a bar. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Hank Williams biographer Colin Escott about his life and music. More and more Americans are living in condos and planned unit developments run by their own private governments, which collect taxes, provide security, trash collection, and street cleaning. Evan McKenzie says these private governments also often curtail the constitutional rights of their residents. We'll talk with McKenzie about his new book, Privatopia. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The State Department reports that about 100 Cubans staying at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay are now being flown to Panama. They'll move into refugee camps there. This is the first group of Cubans to leave Guantanamo since it was opened to them last month as a refuge. This first group is made up of volunteers. Major Rick Thomas is a spokesman for the U.S. Army. He says all the detainees in Guantanamo are getting increasingly upset.
The frustration's there because, you know, the conditions that they're living in are very austere. These are by no means plush environment, and there's not a lot to do in any of the camps. Additionally, and probably foremost, there's a frustration that they're here to begin with because this is not where they ultimately want it to be.
There are at least 21,000 Cuban refugees at the Guantanamo base. They're there with about 14,000 Haitian refugees. Suriname has agreed to take in 2,500 Haitians. Meanwhile, the United States has issued yet another warning to Haiti's military leaders. A U.S. spokesman in Haiti says that American troops will be in that country soon, either to oust the military leaders or to restore order if the generals decide to leave. The spokesman says the likelihood of an invasion has increased with the murder of a prominent Catholic priest last week and the failure of a United Nations mission to meet with Haitian military leaders. Pope John Paul has canceled a planned visit to Sarajevo, the besieged Bosnian capital. The Vatican says the Pope is worried about the safety of local people. Richard Carruthers reports from Zagreb.
Pope John Paul II wanted to spend a few hours in Sarajevo on Thursday and hold an open-air mass. Despite numerous contacts with all warring sides, the Vatican said it had not received sufficient guarantees for the safety of the population. Bosnian Serbs have repeatedly said they could not guarantee the Pope's own safety, claiming they would be blamed for any attack. Security conditions have already deteriorated. The UN says there's been fighting around the airport and the heaviest Serb artillery attack on the besieged capital since the weapons exclusion zone was imposed last March. The Pope says he would still like to visit Sarajevo when circumstances permit, and meantime will go ahead with his trip to predominantly Catholic Croatia over the weekend. For National Public Radio, this is Richard Carruthers in Zagreb.
Ireland's Prime Minister has met with the leader of the Irish Republican Army's political wing. Gerry Adams, leader of Sinn Féin, has pledged a commitment to peace today. These talks triggered outrage from Protestants in Northern Ireland. The British government has offered a cool response. The talks between Adams and Irish Premier Albert Reynolds come less than a week after the IRA declared an open-ended truce in Northern Ireland, but no permanent ceasefire has been discussed. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 11.5 points at 3,897. This is NPR. Aides to President Clinton say that he has rested from his vacation in Martha's Vineyard. He's now rather ready to return to Washington tomorrow. Press Secretary Dee Dee Meyer says Mr. Clinton is also ready to open a new series of speeches that promote the values that he believes Americans share. Meyer says there won't be as much emphasis on the president's legislative agenda that there used to be, but she says the president still hopes to save health care reform in this session. An international organization of legal experts has urged the Japanese government to pay $40,000 to each woman forced into prostitution during World War II. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Tokyo.
In a newly released report, the International Commission of Jurists concludes that Japan's Imperial Army was fully responsible for setting up military brothels and found that life in those brothels was, quote, hell. The Geneva-based human rights group consists of 45 prominent judges, lawyers, and legal scholars whose opinions could influence the United Nations Commission on Human Rights investigating the issue, as well as the Japanese government. But there is little indication Tokyo will be easily prodded into providing direct compensation. It was only last year that Japan admitted for the first time that its military was involved in forced prostitution, and Japan's announcement last week of a $1 billion program to address the issue provides no individual payment to the victims of Japan's wartime policy. In Tokyo, I'm Julie McCarthy.
Lloyd's of London is offering $25,000 for the recovery of jewels and the capture of robbers who made off with more than $1 million in jewels from Tiffany's in New York City. The thieves also stole the store's security cameras. Tiffany says it's open today, but the selection could be poor. Police say two men jumped a security guard late Sunday and forced him at gunpoint to let them into the store. Four guards were tied up, the store was ransacked, and tape taken from the security cameras. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Hank Williams is one of the originators of country music. My guest, Colin Escott, is the author of a new biography of Williams. Escott says Williams made the single most important body of recordings in country music. He set the standard by which success is measured on every level, including self-destruction. Williams died at the age of 29. In his short 6-year recording career, he made such now classic recordings as Your Cheatin' Heart, I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry, Lovesick Blues, Honky Tonkin', Cold Cold Heart, I Can't Help It If I'm Still in Love with You, and Jambalaya. There's a 3-CD box set of his recordings produced by Escott. Colin Escott last joined us on Fresh Air to talk about his book, Good Rockin' Tonight, A History of Sun Records. Let's start with Your Cheatin' Heart, which was released in January of 1953, just a few weeks after Hank Williams' death.
Your cheatin' heart will make you weep. You'll cry and cry and try to sleep. But sleep won't come the whole night through. Your cheating heart will tell on you. When tears come down like falling rain, you'll toss around and call my name. I do. Your cheating heart will tell on you.
Colin Escott, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like you to place Hank Williams for us within country music.
Well, you know, before Hank, country music kind of existed in sort of discrete regional as discrete regional units. You know, you had Western swing on the West Coast, and in Texas and Oklahoma, you had cowboy music, you had East Coast Philadelphia country music, and you had hillbilly music. And I think what Hank did more than anything was to unify country music to the point where it became an identifiable commodity for the first time. You know, after Hank, there was just country music, and that was it.
Tell us a little bit about the family he grew up in and the home he grew up in.
Well, it seems like everyone figures they come from a dysfunctional family these days, but I don't know what Hank really did. You know, his father left home when he was about 6 and went into a Veterans Administration hospital in Louisiana, and Hank didn't see him but maybe once or twice for the next 10 or 12 years. And his mother was a fearsomely independent woman. She started up boarding house businesses, first in little towns like Greenville and Georgiana, and then in Montgomery. And Hank grew up there, but you know, because his mom was running these boarding houses, she really didn't have a lot of time for little Hank. And you know, Hank really grew up by himself, and you can sense a lot of that in the way he sings, you know, that kind of lonesomeness that everyone points out at the core of Hank Williams.
I want to play the very first record that he recorded. This was made in 1942, 6 years before he actually recorded commercially. the recording is I'm Not Coming Home Anymore. Tell us a little bit about the song and the circumstances under which he recorded this.
Well, it was cut at a radio store in Montgomery, and Hank was live every day on WSFA then, which was just about the only radio station of any size in Montgomery. And he had a little 15-minute show. And he was a big noise around Montgomery, and a guy that ran the radio shop there recorded him off the air. And that's really what you're hearing. It's just Hank. And if you listen closely, you can hear an electric guitar and a bass. But really, it's just Hank and his guitar. But the amazing thing is that 6 years before, before Hank became famous, his style was really pretty much in place.
Let's listen.
Oh, there ain't no use to cry, because we're saying goodbye. We have discussed that o'er and gone. So you go your way, you may laugh me kind. I'm not coming home anymore.
In 1946, Hank Williams went to Nashville. Now Nashville's the Tin Pan Alley of country music. What was it like in the mid-40s when he went there?
Well, that's one of the things I really wanted to try and bring out in the book, that Nashville hadn't always been Nashville. You know, today you think of country music, you think of Nashville, like you think of Mutual and Omaha. But back then you had all kinds of regional centers for country music. You had the West Coast, Los Angeles, you had Chicago, you had Cincinnati, you had Philadelphia, and you had Memphis, you had Dallas, and Nashville was just one of many, and it hadn't yet established its preeminence. So when Hank went to Nashville, he wasn't going to the hub of country music as he would be today.
So what was he going to? How many music publishers were there? Were a lot of people recording there?
There were maybe a couple of music publishers in town, certainly no more than that. And there was one little bitty recording studio that was operated as a kind of moonlighting operation by some engineers at the Grand Ole Opry station, WSM. And really, beyond that, there wasn't much. Such industry as there was kind of centered around the Opry. In a way, it's a measure of Hank's achievement that the country music industry focused itself upon Nashville in the years ahead. It was partly due to the preeminence of the Opry, but the Opry's preeminence was partly or perhaps even mostly due to Hank.
So when he got to Nashville, he signed a writer's contract. What did that mean for him?
Well, it was the first step on the ladder. You know, everyone's got to take that first step, and this was Hank's. He had been invited to Nashville because Columbia Records had just signed a very traditional act called Molly O'Day and her Cumberland Mountain Folks. And Fred Rose, the music publisher, who was the one big music publisher in Nashville, had been assigned to find songs for Molly O'Day. And no one in his little operation was churning out anything that he thought Molly could use. And Molly told him about this guy down in Montgomery who was churning out just the kind of songs that she needed. And in that way, Hank came to Nashville.
I want to play one of Hank Williams' first commercially released recordings. And this is Move It On Over. Do you think that, in a way, this is one of his most important up-tempo recordings?
Well, it is, because what you hear there is the clear debt to black music. You know, there really hadn't been a whole lot of black music influence in hillbilly music up to that point. And, in Move It On Over, you can hear the debt that Hank owed to the black rural string bands that he'd grown up listening to, down in southern Alabama.
This is Move It On Over, Hank Williams.
Came in last night at 10:30. That baby of mine wouldn't let me in, so move it on over.
Move it on over.
Move it on over.
Move it on over.
Cause the big dog's moving in. She's changed the lock on our front door. My door key don't fit no more. So get it on over.
Move it on over.
Scoot it on over.
Move it on over.
Move over, skinny dog. Cause the fat dog's moving in.
My guest is Colin Escott. He's written a new biography of Hank Williams. He also produced a 3-CD set of Hank Williams recordings. Now, you say that this recording, Moving On Over, shows the influence of black music on Hank Williams. He actually learned to play guitar from a black street musician.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I wish to God I could have been there so that I know exactly what it was that Hank got off this guy. I mean, his name was T-Tot, or his nickname was T-Tot, because he drank out of a flask that had a mixture of tea and alcohol in it. And Hank used to follow him around almost obsessively. And he'd pay T-Tot, you know, whatever little money he could scrounge up to teach him what? I don't know, teach him chords maybe, certainly teach him in broader strokes, like the importance of getting a good rhythm going and how to project to an audience and things like that.
You know, I think a lot of us, because the South was segregated, a lot of us are surprised when we hear about a white musician who learned from a black musician or by a white musician who was so influenced by black music.
Yeah, I mean, everyone tends to think that all started with Elvis Presley, but of course it didn't. And even before Hank, you had Yodel and Jimmy Rogers down in Meridian, Mississippi, who grew up listening to the blues musicians down there. And when he started singing, it was a kind of curious mixture of you know, 1920s blues and sentimental Victorian pop songs. And you know, Rogers is called the father of country music, and you know, half of what he sang really was blues, but it was rarer, much rarer, in hillbilly music, which really was rooted in Anglo-Celtic forms. And Hank was the first person to introduce elements of black music into hillbilly music.
My guest is Colin Escott. He's written a new biography of Hank Williams. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking with Colin Escott about his new biography of Hank Williams. Hank Williams recording Lovesick Blues is one of his most famous recordings. It was a turning point in his career, and it turns out it was a show tune. It was from a musical review. Tell us about the origins of this song.
Boy, how long have you got? I mean, this is a song that dated back to 1922, which made it a year older than Hank. And it was for a failed Broadway show called Ooh, Ernest, which was about lovesick airmen during the First World War. And it kicked around in one form or another. And by the time Hank got it, it had mutated a few times and lost a few chords. And the verses had become the chorus. And really, I mean, Hank's music publisher said it was a mess, and it was a mess. But Hank had been working on this thing and working on it and working on it. And even though what emerged was a mess, it was so compelling. I mean, it was a compelling mess, and I mean, it was almost a numbingly inconsequential song. It wasn't really a blues. It certainly wasn't a country song, but it just had that little magic thing that just made radio audiences sit up and take notice.
Well, this is Hank Williams' recording of Lovesick Blues.
I got a feeling of the blues, oh Lord, since my baby said goodbye. Lord, I don't know what I'll do. All I do is sit and sigh. Oh Lord, that last long day she said goodbye. Well, Lord, I thought I would cry. She'll do me, she'll do you. She's got that kind of loving. Lord, I love to hear her when she called me sweet daddy. Such a beautiful dream. I hate to think it all over. I've lost my heart, it seems. I've grown so used to you somehow. Well, I'm nobody's sugar daddy now. And I'm lonesome. I got the lovesick blues.
This recording, you call this the spark that ignited his career. Even though he didn't write the song, how did it change his career?
Well, Hank was in Louisiana. He was playing the Louisiana Hayride, which was one of the Opry's rivals. It was a rival Saturday Night Jubilee. And he wasn't writing. He'd stopped writing songs for some reason. And he'd resuscitated this old song from songs that he'd learned growing up. And he started playing it on shows, and people seemed to like it on shows. And then he started playing it on the hayride, and people liked it on the hayride. And then he recorded it, and from playing it on the hayride, he had this sort of backlog of people who wanted to buy it lined up halfway across the country, and it just exploded. It was just one of those things, like the Banana Boat song a few years later. It just became one of those huge, uncontainable monster hit records that no one could explain, and it was the catalyst that got him out of the minor leagues and got him into the majors.
After the success of Lovesick Blues, Hank Williams became a regular cast member of the Opry.
Well, yeah, you know, the Opry now seems like the only game in town when it comes to Saturday night radio jamborees, but it certainly wasn't then. There were hundreds of them, and the Opry was running scared of two or three of them, particularly the Louisiana Hayride that Hank was on. And they recruited him from the Hayride, afraid that he was going to act as a kind of spearhead attraction for the Hayride and help it to overtake the Opry. So they hired him away, and then, you know, he was pleased to come.
So he helped make the Opry more successful when he came over.
Absolutely.
I want to move on to "I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry." This was actually the B-side of "My Bucket's Got a Hole in It." What were they thinking when they released that as the B-side?
Well, one thing you got to appreciate is that a lot of Hank's records, all of Hank's records, were aimed at jukeboxes. They weren't aimed at buyers, you know, like record buyers, the way they are today. The primary customer for records back then was jukebox operators. And, you know, when people went to punch up a record on a jukebox, they didn't want to hear a slow, mournful song. They wanted something with a bit of zip in it. And, you know, "My Bucket's Got a Hole in It" was just the ticket. And "I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry," for all its poeticism and everything, just didn't play as well on jukeboxes.
So how did "I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry" become the real... I assume that was the side that finally sold.
No, it wasn't. "My Bucket's Got a Hole in It" was the side that sold. That was the one that got up to number one and number two on the charts. "I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry" was just kind of languished as a B-side, and it wasn't until after Hank died and people started looking back at you know, started investigating his catalog in a little more detail, that they found songs like "I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry" and "You Win Again," which was another B-side.
Well, let's hear "I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry."
Hear that lonesome whippoorwill. He sounds too blue to fly. The midnight train is whining low. I'm so lonesome I could cry. I've never seen a night so long when time goes crawling by. The moon just went behind the clouds to hide its face and cry.
Colin Escott is my guest. He's written a new biography of Hank Williams. You say by 1951, Williams' career was controlling him. What were the problems he was having?
Well, most people wouldn't regard them as problems. You know, he was getting invitations from television networks to go on nationwide television. He was getting approaches from MGM's. You know, he recorded for MGM Records, and he was getting approaches from the movie division to make movies. He was being asked to headline country music shows in Boston, in Las Vegas, and just all over. Yeah, but Hank had a much keener sense of his limitations than anyone else did. And he was a guy who really didn't have a whole lot of education, and who 3 or 4 years earlier had been playing little schoolhouse dates and honky-tonks and beer joints down in Louisiana and Alabama and East Texas for peanuts, really. And he found it very, very hard to cope with this new audience and the incredible career pressures of having to be at a certain place at a certain time. But when he started out, he'd play a beer joint, and if he showed, he showed. If he didn't, he'd do a make good if he felt like it. And if he didn't feel like it, he'd just blow it off. It all began to weigh heavily upon him.
Williams was a heavy drinker as far back as when he was a teenager. By the early 50s, how was alcohol affecting his reputation as a performer and a person?
Well, Hank's first response to stress was always to go reach for the bottle, and he did that more and more, partly because of the career pressures and partly because he suffered from a spinal condition called spina bifida, which must have been incredibly painful for him, riding those hundreds of thousands of miles in the car. And he drank basically to escape the career pressures and escape the pain that he had almost constantly from about 1950, 51 onwards in his back. And the alcohol began to make him very unreliable. By the end of 51, the drinking was really starting to get out of control.
He was taking pain medication then, too.
That's right, yeah. He was mixing it with heavy-duty barbiturates. And, this was starting to affect his show rate, the reliability of him turning up was sinking from maybe 85-90% to maybe 500, maybe 50%.
He was only 29 when he died. What killed him?
It was a combination of everything he was doing. It was a combination of morphine, which he was taking for his back, chloral hydrate, which he was taking for his back pain, and alcohol, together with a generally dissipated physical condition that came from the lifestyle he had led for the last 5 or 6 years, really. Everything weighed upon him, and by the time he died, he was really a man without another option. He was physically wrecked. The back pain was irremediable. The alcoholism was something that he couldn't escape from, no matter how hard he tried. And his death, which has so often been described as a dreadful accident, was just an accident that was waiting to happen.
Colin Escott, do you think that Hank Williams influenced country music not only in terms of his music, but also in terms of himself as the tragic figure? I mean, that sense of the tragic figure has become so important in the mythology of country music.
Yeah, everyone, when someone drives their truck into Nashville hoping to make it in the business, they've always got Hank Williams in the back of their mind and always thinking that they're going to avoid his terrible fate. But that live hard, love fast, die young thing is just rooted in, it's just part of country music mythology.
Colin Escott, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Colin Escott is the author of a new biography of Hank Williams. He also produced a CD box set of Williams' recordings. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Well, why don't you love me like you used to do? How come you treat me like a worn-out shoe? My hair's still curly and my eyes are still blue. Why don't you love me like you used to do? Ain't had no loving like a hugging and a kissing and a long, long while. We don't get nearer, further, closer than a country mile.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Privatopia. We talk with Evan McKenzie about the social impact of private communities, condos and planned unit developments that have their own governments, police protection, garbage pickup, street maintenance, and their own rules of conduct. McKenzie says they offer affordable housing, but the price you pay may be your personal freedom. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The United States has begun transferring Cuban refugees to safe haven camps in Panama. Military officials hope to ease some of the current crowding at the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay. U.S. troops in Panama are preparing to receive as many as 10,000 Cuban refugees. The first group has already departed, and a second group of refugees will leave tomorrow. The Pentagon also says a group of 150 Haitian refugees who've been also staying in Guantanamo will be sent to Suriname. At least 21,000 Cubans and more than 14,000 Haitians are now at the Guantanamo base. The American ambassador to Japan is in Washington today. He told a group gathered at the National Press Club that crime and violence in the United States are tarnishing its image abroad. UPI's Bill Small prepared this report.
Former Vice President, now Ambassador Walter Mondale says the issue of crime and violence in America looks differently from Tokyo than it does from Washington or his home state of Minnesota. Mondale told a National Press Club luncheon that America's message abroad is becoming overshadowed by the violence at home.
The wanton availability of guns, the soaring number of murders and violence, the lack of safety in the streets, it really causes them to question whether we're falling apart.
Mondale says the United States must show the rest of the world that it is coming to grips with the problems of guns, crime, and violence. Bill Small, Washington.
Ireland's prime minister met with the head of the Irish Republican Army's political wing today. The leaders emerged from their first official session saying they were totally and absolutely committed to democratic and peaceful methods of resolving their political problems. Reporter Mike Moran is in London. He says Prime Minister Albert Reynolds is in a tricky position as he tries to move the peace process along.
What Mr. Reynolds is doing is accepting the IRA's ceasefire as permanent. In fact, several Sinn Féin officials over the last weekend have come closer and closer to saying exactly that, that this is a permanent ceasefire. But so far, Downing Street has been unwilling to react positively to it. They apparently want to hear the words coming out of Mr. Adams' mouth, even if it's only going to be heard by an actor's voice here in Britain.
The British government has a ban on broadcasting the voices of Sinn Féin and IRA representatives. Children in Washington, D.C. aren't in school today because school officials haven't repaired major fire code violations. A superior court judge must first authorize their reopening. 164 schools are shuttered. There were 11,000 fire code violations in the most recent school check, which was conducted 5 years ago. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed mixed today, gaining more than 13 points to end the day at 3,898. This is NPR. State police in New Mexico have arrested a man and a teenager wanted in a multi-state crime spree in Ohio, Missouri, and Oklahoma. Authorities say the men were taken without incident today in Santa Fe. They're suspected of kidnapping, car thefts, and three murders. Vice President Al Gore has met with Vatican representatives during the UN Population Conference in Cairo. Both sides discussed their differences over abortion, and delegates have started debating the issue. NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
As the debate on abortion got underway at the Cairo Conference Center, Vice President Al Gore met with a Vatican representative to discuss the question. So far, there's been no substantial progress on the issue, but delegates from the European Union are trying to diffuse some of the controversy over abortion with proposed changes in the language of the draft UN population plan. The Vatican and other critics of the document believe that terms like reproductive rights and reproductive health are really endorsements for abortion on demand. Supporters of the UN plan, including Vice President Gore, have repeatedly said the document does not promote abortion as a family planning method. Many delegates here in Cairo are concerned that the controversy is drawing attention away from one of the main goals of the conference, to improve the status of women through better health care and education programs. I'm Lynn Neary in Cairo.
Liberian peace talks being held in Ghana have been secretive. Ghanaian officials only say the talks are being held in a town some 65 miles north of Accra, the capital. Ghana's information minister says all factional leaders, including Charles Taylor, will attend. Taylor heads the main armed Liberian faction. Ghanaian President Jerry Rawlings will chair the talks, which he convened. One Liberian peace agreement, which was signed a year ago, is in shreds. Fighting between factions has broken out in several places in Liberia. Supervised disarmament by the UN has not happened, and scheduled free elections were supposed to be held tomorrow. They won't be. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you don't live in the type of housing we're about to discuss, you may live in it soon, since it's the fastest-growing form of housing. It's called the common interest development, and it includes condominiums, co-ops, and planned unit developments. Everybody who buys a unit is required to join a homeowners association. My guest, Evan McKenzie, says these homeowners associations are like private governments, and these new communities are a hybrid of utopian ideals and American privatism. He calls them privatopias. McKenzie is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Illinois at Chicago. In his new book, Privatopia, he raises questions about the social and economic impact of these communities. He says new buyers are sometimes surprised to find their new home comes along with over 100 pages of rules and regulations restricting their behavior. Here's some examples.
A large number of them are architectural restrictions that say such things as you can't paint your house any color except beige or blue or some earth tone, something like that. Restrictions on fences, saying that you can't build a fence or that if you do, you have to seek permission to do it. Restrictions on planting gardens, hanging things from your windows. And then, in addition to architectural restrictions, there are frequently behavioral restrictions. For example, restrictions on having pets. Many communities say you can't have children or you can't have anyone living in the development below a certain age, say 45 years of age. Restrictions on having parties past a certain time. In some cases, you can't have more than a certain number of people in your unit without seeking the permission of the association first. And then where there are private streets in many of these developments, they frequently enforce private speed limits, so that you can actually ultimately be not only fined but banned from your development for repeat speeding offenses in your community.
And you point out that the homeowners associations can limit behavior without regard to constitutional rights. Why is that?
Well, that's because homeowner associations are private organizations, usually private corporations. And the Bill of Rights of the U.S. Constitution only applies to what we call state action, or in other words, it protects individuals against the actions of government, either the national government in Washington or the states or the cities in which people live. So if private organizations engage in activities that infringe on constitutional liberties, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, really doesn't apply to what they do. Courts view homeowner association activity as though you had joined the Kiwanis Club or something of that sort, and that's a private organization. If you don't like their rules, if they say you have to wear a certain kind of hat to their meeting or whatever, the courts say, well, that's consensual conduct, that's private activity. You're not faced with the tyranny of a government here. And so you don't need the Bill of Rights to protect you, and so you don't have it to protect you, even though many of the things homeowner associations do are very similar to what cities do.
What do you call these kinds of developments, privatopia?
There's a real utopian strain in this type of housing that goes back well over about 100 years, really. And you can trace that fairly accurately if you go back and look at works written in the 1890s and the early part of this century. And many people, when they started developing this type of housing, thought they had really hit upon the ideal way to live. And I think if you look at the marketing of this type of housing, you get a kind of utopian strain in the present day, that they sort of tell people, you know, this is the best place to live. It may not be heaven on earth, but it's as close as you're going to get. And their path to that is through privatizing the functions of local government and putting them in the hands of homeowner associations.
Now, do you see the privatizing aspect as being at odds with the utopian aspect?
I think we really need to ask some serious questions about this, because it may be that many people who live in this type of housing think they've found utopia, and that the way they found it is through getting away from government, getting away from the cities. And there's a real anti-government strain in a lot of the rhetoric that I hear about homeowner associations from people who live in them sometimes and like them. But when people set themselves apart from society and live in a separate and distinct way according to a separate and distinct set of rules, while we may say people should have the right to do that, I think we have to ask about the consequences to the larger society of large numbers of people doing that. You know, if it were a few hundred people doing it, that would be one thing. If it's many, many, many people doing it, that's another question. In two senses. First, for the people who live there. If a small group of people go set up their own society and they're happy living that way, that's fine. But when large numbers of people are essentially drafted into living in this type of housing because they can't find affordable housing in their areas other than CID housing, they may not want this type of living, but they may be forced into it for economic reasons. So for them, these restrictions may not be utopia. And then what about the larger society? I think we should ask questions about the impact of having 30, 40, 50, 60 million people eventually living in large part outside the urban community as we know it.
You know, what about the larger social impact of that? Do you see the people who live in these common interest developments as seceding from the larger government?
I think many of them perceive it that way, yes. And, you know, it sets up a situation in which I think it encourages people to see themselves that way. The sort of epitome of this type of community is the gated, walled community with the security gates and private streets that you can't enter without permission. And so it's physically set apart from other people. And then economically, when you live in a development like this, you know, you're essentially taxed. They call them assessments by your association to maintain the common areas and to reserve large amounts of money for future repairs to the property. And that's all sound business practice, but, you know, it imposes an extra economic burden on the people who live in these communities. In some cases, they're paying $250, $350 a month in assessments. And that's a lot of money, especially when you add it onto your property tax. Now, they may get things for that, private pools, recreation facilities, and so forth, and those may be nice things and extra security. But when it comes time to pay their property tax bill, many people in this industry have been saying, you know, this is what they call double taxation. And they're arguing that you should not have to pay property tax and to support public facilities and private assessments to support private facilities that duplicate them. Now, you know, we might say, well, gee whiz, you know, you get to use those public facilities too. But nonetheless, this is a powerful economic incentive for people to say, hey, we want special tax breaks. In other words, we want not to pay property taxes. We would rather pay just our own assessments to our own little private government. We don't want to pay to support public facilities. And that cry has been heard throughout the country from CID residents and their representatives in the legislatures.
Well, what impact do you think it would have on city governments and townships if the people in these community in these common interest developments stopped paying taxes or paid less taxes?
If homeowner assessments were fully deductible from property tax, it would be something on the order of $20 to $30 billion in lost revenues to the cities and counties across the country. And in particular, the areas that are heavily impacted by this type of housing, where it has just blossomed in just in an incredible rate, such as Orange County in California, parts of Florida, Texas, the Bay Area in the San Francisco Bay Area, parts of New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania. The Pennsylvania suburbs, say Valley Forge and so forth, those particular areas where there are large amounts of housing, where maybe 60, 70, 80% of the housing that has been built in the last 20 years is this type of housing, those cities and counties could literally become insolvent if they lost all that tax revenue. So in certain areas, the impact could be colossal.
My guest is Evan McKenzie, and he's the author of a new book called Privatopia, Homeowner Associations and the Rise of Residential Private Government. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Evan McKenzie, and we're talking about homeowners associations and common interest developments. He's the author of the new book, Privatopia. Now, you're worried about people who belong to these developments basically trying to secede from their local governments. But on the other hand, aren't a lot of the local governments really pleased with these common interest developments because it means the government doesn't have to worry about building the roads or handling the sewage system or even providing security there because that's all privatized?
Yes, that's absolutely right. Hand in hand with the large-scale real estate developers who build this type of housing has been local government. In the Sun Belt, typically, and in the rapidly growing areas, the so-called edge cities, as Joel Garreau calls them, of the country. They have, and the reason is, of course, because they've been in a major fiscal crisis that started in the mid-70s, where they have a really difficult time maintaining their existing infrastructure, much less building new infrastructure for new residents. So when a developer comes along and says, I'd like to build a development with 500 homes in it, and the city turns to them and says, well, now, wait a minute. That means we have to build a new school and a new park, and we have to build streets and roads and sewer hookups and all these other things. And the developer says, wait a minute. You don't have to build any of it. I'll build all that. And it will be owned and maintained by the homeowner association, or in some cases deeded to the public, but generally maintained by the people who live there. And then the city says, you mean we get all these taxpayers, property taxpayers, without having to build infrastructure? Wonderful, and it's a great deal. And so they have essentially collaborated to a large extent. However, now they are, I think in some areas, are beginning to question that decision, because now that those residents are getting organized politically, which is happening across the country, now they are demanding special tax breaks. Now they're saying, we don't want to pay property taxes. We don't want to pay. We have duplicate services. The cities say, well, that's why we let you build this development, developer. The developer is, of course, long gone, and now it's taken over by the residents, and they say they have an unfair tax burden. Well, that tax burden was placed on them by the developer in the city. That was the condition for building them in the first place.
What's the advantage to developers of building residents that have the common space where the developer has to take the responsibility for the infrastructure and the roads and all that? Why would they want to take that much on instead of just building a bunch of homes?
Well, because there are great economies of scale in building this way. In fact, this type of housing, although it's been around for over 100 years, began to become popular in the early 1960s. And the reason was because the supply of suburban land was beginning to shrink, because there had been so much housing constructed from 1946 at the end of World War II through the early 60s that really the land cost, the cost to the developer of just buying and preparing the land on which these houses were built, was becoming really oppressive for them. So they were faced with a problem. Either they had to raise the price of housing, which threatened to put it out of reach of the middle class. People would not be able to afford to buy these houses if they priced them properly. Or they had to shrink the size of the lots. But people really had become accustomed to living in these large Ozzie and Harriet-style homes with their own yards. It's very hard to increase density for Americans because they're kind of used to having their own turf. So they hit upon this idea. They went back to the old idea of the planned communities that had been built early in the century, luxury subdivisions for the wealthy mostly. And they began to turn to what they called cluster subdivisions. And this is where the CID concept really took off in the early 1960s. It was embraced by the Federal Housing Administration. And essentially it enables them to do this. They can squeeze more people on less land because, so for several reasons. First, you give people small yards instead of big yards, but then give them a commonly owned open space on which everyone can play, so they don't need a big yard. You shrink the size of the streets. Now, if the city builds a street or owns a street, they will not let you build it too narrowly because people can't park and drive on it. But if it's a private street, it can be very narrow. And that allows the developer to put more houses in the development because the streets are narrower. All these things are big cost savings for the developer. And it is true that they have to incur the capital cost up front of doing that, but the maintenance cost all gets passed on to the owners. So essentially, the developers save money on the construction. That's one of the main reasons they do it, and they can put more houses on less land.
You know, you've made the point that the homeowners associations aren't subjected to adhering to the Constitution because they're private groups, and it's understood that the people who belong to the homeowners associations are doing it out of choice. They're it's like joining a club or something. It's a private organization. But you say that it's not always so much of a choice. Sometimes you have no choice but to live in a place like this because it's all you can afford or because it's all that's available. Were you ever in a predicament like that where you had to move to a common interest development even though you didn't want to because you had no choice?
No, I was not forced to do that. Had I been, in the course of looking for work, for example, suppose I ended up working in Orange County, California, I would find myself in a place where 80% of the housing that has been built in the last 15 to 20 years is common interest housing. If I were teaching at the University of California at Irvine or someplace like that, it would be almost an impossible task to find housing that's not this type of housing. The exception would be if I had a tremendous amount of money, because if you want the old traditional single-family style house, they're still available in most places, but in these areas where this type of housing has been built, typically property values are high. That's why they're building it. They're building it there, A, because the developers like to build in places with high property values, and secondly, because one of the goals with common interest housing is to make it a little bit more affordable so that middle-class people can afford to buy it. So I might be able to find this type of housing if I had a lot of money to do it, or if I were willing to commute an enormous distance. But, you know, all these things are factors that tend to channel people toward common interest housing.
My guest is Evan McKenzie. He's the author of the new book, Privatopia. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, Noah Adams is in Ireland. What's he reporting on today?
Today he is on the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic. He is reporting on the efforts of the two countries to cope with the possibility of peace. And Ireland is continuing to declare peace. England is still skeptical. We also have a piece from Russia, from Brooke Gladstone. The Russians go back to school to learn new ideas. Their history texts and their maps have been revised. And we have a freshman Democrat in a Republican district running for re-election. The transformation of the outsider of the last election to the incumbent of this election could sink him.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Back with Evan McKenzie, author of the new book Privatopia, Homeowners Associations and the Rise of Residential Private Government. Now, you're an academic, you're a professor, but you're also a lawyer, and in fact, I believe you have represented homeowners associations.
That's right, I did, for about 5 to 6 years.
In what kinds of fights?
In lawsuits against developers alleging that the development had been constructed with defects in it, it was physically defective in some way, that the soils were collapsing or expanding and cracking the foundations, that the roofs leaked, that the windows leaked, that in one case the whole development was built on top of an ancient landslide that was moving and destroying the homes gradually. It's called construction defect lawsuits, and I represented homeowner associations in that type of suit for a number of years.
Did your work representing homeowners associations lead to looking at common interest developments as a larger social issue?
Yes, it did. That's just what happened. I began to meet the directors of these associations as I started working on this type of case, and I started realizing that just this enormous responsibility had fallen upon these ordinary citizens. And I started thinking, how in the world did this happen? I was about halfway through doing my graduate work in political science, and I was practicing law at the time. And so I was attuned to the concept in political science that we call private government. It's been a concept in political science for decades. And I suddenly, it just hit me right in the face. These are private governments. These people are doing, they're running small cities. And it just shocked me because here would be these ordinary people. They work all day. They have a job. They're secretaries or they're in some cases lawyers, or they work in, they sell cars, sell insurance. And then they've been elected to run this little city in which they live. There's nobody supporting them, nobody training them. Nobody tells them how to do it. They're totally reliant on me as their lawyer or a property manager to tell them what to do, and suddenly they're confronted, in this the cases I was involved with what might be a tremendous amount of money. They have to make a decision about millions of dollars. Should we settle this case? Should we go to trial and risk losing everything? Should we pay an expert $100,000 to do an investigation of this problem that we have here? And the responsibility was enormous, and they were so dependent on their lawyers to tell them what to do. I started thinking about this very hard, and I started thinking, this really needs to be looked at. I looked around, and there was very little written on the subject, and except for industry publications, and so I thought it would be good to give it an academic treatment, and that's what I did with my dissertation and then later the book.
So you're giving us warnings now about the larger social repercussions of these privatized governments and homeowners associations. Why should anyone care who doesn't live with a homeowners association and doesn't plan on moving into such a development? What?
Well, for two reasons. One is you're liable to find yourself living in one. People, because the former president of the largest trade association in this industry said a couple of years ago, he gave a speech in Canada. He said by the year 2000, 25% to 30% of Americans will be living in homeowner associations. What people don't understand is that the real estate industry, the large-scale developers who build most of our housing, have overwhelmingly embraced this concept. This is what they're building, mm-hmm. and in the rapidly growing parts of the country. So people are liable to find themselves sucked into a development like this, almost like a vacuum cleaner, whether they like it or not. Market logic may force them into it. And so that's a question. Secondly, if you live in any city in America that has a large concentration of homeowner associations, you need to start thinking about the tax consequences, about the political consequences. I mean, for example, if there is going to be a bond issue floated for to build a park in the city, and 40% of the people in the jurisdiction live in a homeowner association or associations with their own parks, are they going to vote in favor of building a public park or not? Or will they be inclined to say, we have a park, we don't need to vote for a public park? So particularly when they're paying hundreds of dollars per month in assessments. Are they going to make a demand for rebates? The whole state of New Jersey is currently giving rebates to all the people who live in homeowner associations. That's going to affect the people who don't. That is going to have dramatic impact on the people of the state of New Jersey. That just went into effect this year. So I really think that everyone is impacted by this, whether they realize it or not. And everyone is impacted by the overall phenomenon of the privatization of public life. That is affecting us all at this moment, culturally, politically, socially.
Evan McKenzie, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Evan McKenzie is the author of Privatopia. He teaches political science at the University of Chicago at Illinois. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Audrey Bentham, and Chris Fraley. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Space Age Bachelor Pad Music. We talk with Juan Garcia Escovel, the creator of oddball middle-of-the-road music. And we'll talk with producer Irwin Chusett about why he's reissued Escovel's recordings. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air. Yeah.